Welcome to BCLP's Client Intelligent Podcast. I'm your host, Nelly DeGogel, and today we're talking about DEI, that's diversity, equity, and inclusion. Some say that DEI is at a critical juncture in 2024. While our workplaces look and sound very different to how they did 20 years ago, there are concerns that the DEI agenda is under threat amidst a resurgence of skepticism and pushback. Today, we're speaking to two rock stars in the field of DEI. Daisy Reeves, Global DEI Client Relationship Partner at BCLP across its 31 international offices, and Ken Janssens, co-founder at Window and a former Chief Data Officer at JP Morgan. Together, we're going to gauge the current temperature of the world of DEI, and we'll be looking ahead to what's in store for this important field. So, Daisy and Ken, thank you so much for joining me. I'd like to start by asking you to introduce yourselves to our audience and tell us a little bit about what you do.
Well, thank you, Nelly. Before we start to go into talking about what we do, isn't it nice, Ken, to be introduced as rock stars in our field? So you've put quite a high bar in. So let's hope we perform, Ken.
I'm running with rock star from now on.
I think that's right. So both Ken and I have innovative roles. As you referenced at the top, Nelly, I am the global DEI client relationship partner at BCLP. What does that actually mean? Because I am the only person in legal in the world that has my job. So I am a partner, 100% dedicated, pro bono to talking to our clients and communities about inclusion and diversity to really shift that metaphorical dial, which has always needed WD-40, but needs WD-40 now in a way that perhaps it didn't need so much a couple of years ago, which I guess we'll touch on. But that is me and that is what I do. Ken.
Hi, so I'm Ken and I'm the co-founder of Window and head of social impact. And our mission is to connect young talent with employers that share their values. And we pride ourselves on tracking the sustainability and DEI profiles of 500 plus companies in the US, the UK, France and Germany. And the platform is fully open to all. And this positions us uniquely to understand DEI reporting trends and DEI performance. And our community of 500 plus university society leaders also provides us with a deep understanding of what the next generation expects from their future workplaces.
Firstly, I wanted to talk a little bit about your own personal stories when it comes to DEI. You're both trailblazers for LGBTQ plus visibility in the workplace. Could you tell me about what it was like to come out in the city, especially working in quite traditional fields?
Well, we're pretty similar vintages, I think, Ken.
Yes, we are.
but we're not a big amorphous lump or homogenous lump. We have similar but different stories. So I don't think it's just coming out in the city, although the city was and remains a unique beast. But coming out in mid-90s, would that be the same for you, Ken? It was a very, very, very different time. And I think that notwithstanding what commentators say, we do have to acknowledge how far we have come. I mean, neither of us, we're both married, not to each other, but we're both married. That wasn't something that was possible. Mm. Coming out in the city and in legal, certainly when I was at university and I was out at law school as well, and I think it's probably similar to you, Ken, went back in the closet when I went to my law firm, which was then Berman Leighton Paisen and now BCLP. That's not because the law firm was a particularly homophobic place. It's just that there was no visibility of LGBTQ people in legal City of London. I think I knew of one male partner. That was it. There were certainly no lesbians. I mean, there didn't seem to be any lesbians anywhere. Martina Navratilova, and that was about it. So some of us decided to metaphorically stand up with the rainbow flag, be seen. And that's led us to, I guess, where we are now. But that's my story. And it's a different world now, thank goodness.
Yeah, so very similar. I was out at university, but when I joined JP Morgan in 1997, I went back in the closet. But luckily, I didn't really have to be in the closet for too long, about 3 years. And that was because there was enough senior managers at JP Morgan that were very clear about their support for LGBTQ plus employees. But still, I felt I was taking a risk, particularly as I was working on the trading floor, which is a place that is notorious for not being the most accepting. But still, I sort of ran the calculus in my head, and I thought if someone was going to make a homophobic comment to me, they would probably be more in trouble than me. Mm. And I'm very happy to say that in the subsequent 22 years of being at JP Morgan, I never received a homophobic comment. And that includes being sent on expat assignments to New York, Tokyo, and Sao Paulo.
I think that there's also, for certain strands of DEI, such as LGBTQ or disability, etc., there's a lot of invisibility to it. So you have to be even more intentional to step up and wave your hand and say, you know, I am here, because you can't be what you can't see.
Of course. And I imagine that takes a lot of bravery to take that first step. Well, I just want to pivot to the current landscape of DEI, both in the UK and globally. What are your assessments of where we're at when it comes to DEI right now? A temperature check, if you like. You know, we seem to be in a period of potential pushback. Is DEI really under threat?
Well, I think I'm actually very positive about this. I think two decades on, DEI has come of age. You know, there's a growing emphasis on measurable outcomes and accountability. Companies are being held to account by their stakeholders. That includes incoming talent, customers, and investors to make good on their DEI commitments. And that's leading to a more data-driven approach, aiming for transparency, tangible progress, rather than vague promises. And just to illustrate that, Apple now has a board that is 50% women. 44% of Accenture's executives are from an ethnic minority. 8.4% of the Bank of England's senior management are LGBTQ+. And 8% of KPMG's UK partners identify as having a disability. So yes, DEI is under attack by a small but very vocal minority on the right. But what I'm seeing very clearly through the reporting is that leading companies are staying focused on DEI and making progress. And they may talk about it less publicly, but they're getting on with it.
Yeah, I agree, Ken. And you're right to raise and acknowledge the anti-woke supposed backlash. There's no doubt about it that there are a group of people now that think it's okay to raise their voices to say, why on earth are we doing this? Perhaps they wouldn't have done that a couple of years ago because of the polemic in the press. I completely agree with you, Ken. It's not quite as done in terms of the death of DEI as one perhaps may believe from reading the press. So just to credentialise that, so where we're sitting here beaming out from now is the UK. And two centres of excellence that the UK is known for is legal, I would say that, but we are a lot of contracts are still governed by the laws of England, Wales, and financial services. It's a huge part of our GDP.
Sure.
If you look at the regulators for both of those market-leading industries globally, both of those regulators are enshrining, this isn't something old, this is something current, they are enshrining DEI into their regulations, which they are asking their members to adhere to. So let's talk about financial services. So this year, the FCA and the PRA, and they've been working with financial services organisations to get to where we are now, but they should be publishing proper regulations around financial services industries must have a formal DEI strategy, be accountable for it, measure data, have targets. Now, I don't have a crystal ball, and at the time of recording this, there have indeed been some vocal opponents of these proposals from certain quarters. But in my opinion, even if the FCA and PRA end up retrenching, I hope not, but there are no formal suggestions, by the way, that they're proposing to. But if they do, the proposals that have been tabled so far are so comprehensive that even with cutbacks, there will be an improved and embedded framework for the financial institutions, their members, in my opinion. Then taking a step across the pond, and I'll give you an anecdote. Someone who was at this meeting told this to me. So in the US, you may have heard about the affirmative action challenges, particularly at higher education level, which have been successful, saying that university programs that are aimed towards helping minority communities, that there's too much affirmative action. However, there's a group of general counsel, so the most senior lawyers within the top companies in the US, and they meet from time to time. I was speaking to one of them in October or November, and they had just come back from the most recent session. I think maybe 80 to 90 of those GCs turned up at that session, and it was with the exception of maybe one or two who were quiet on it, 80 or 90 of those GCs said, we are absolutely still behind our core values. Yes, we're looking at our policies to make sure that there's less risk of affirmative action cases being brought, if indeed they could be, but we are still 100% behind our core values, and those core values are around DEIs.
Yeah, and that's hugely encouraging. I want to focus a bit on how businesses and what are those key trends in how businesses can approach DEI right now in an actual meaningful way? So what are some of those key trends that businesses can adopt?
Well, I think two trends I would focus on. One, which is I'm personally really excited about is this growing focus on socioeconomic diversity, equity, and inclusion. So that's really making sure that those from a lower socioeconomic background have equal opportunity and pay. And law firms, including BCLP and consulting firms, are leading the way here. And what I think is really interesting about this new sort of strand of DEI is that it includes white men. Mm. And I think it's just really powerful to look at that as a company. Another big trend is a focus on intersectionality, which recognizes that people experience discrimination differently based on the intersection of their various identities, such as race, gender, sexual orientation, disability, and socioeconomic background. That's really when I think it becomes very powerful.
I agree, particularly around the social mobility, the growth of interest in that. Mm. And in terms of tools to live that. And let's just acknowledge, and I don't think it's something that we've said yet, but this isn't all about being a fluffy, nice, happy workplace. If that's the byproduct, great. Mm. But the reason that companies are doing this, the reason that regulators are doing this, is because they want the best people that come from all different walks of life. They want to reduce groupthink. This is a risk mitigant, a business imperative. So to the social mobility point, what we're doing at BCLP and certain other organisations are doing it is not focusing, I guess it's at entry level, on grades in the way that historically we would have done. If you don't get 3 A's, then your application form isn't through the door. It's much more around contextual recruitment and not assuming, this is not about bashing public school, but what it is doing is saying some of those people will be more polished than perhaps someone who's come through the comprehensive system. Again, these are massive generalizations, mm-hmm. but it's looking at skills-based assessments. So yes, we look at grades, but what we want to look at is how do these people operate if they're in a reasoning or a negotiation?
It's about appreciating that there are so many different ways of learning and ways of applying skills that go beyond sort of more traditional ways that we assess, you know, success, for instance.
I think that the other key trend is there's a real focus on the whole person, so on well-being, so all elements of health, whether that's, you know, physical health, but also mental health and subjects that were previously, I guess, off the table or taboo. So in the UK, menopause, period health, prostate health for men, mental health to say coping with burnout. Again, the right thing to do, but also in businesses' interests, but to keep their people happy and healthy.
Yeah, and this actually leads so beautifully into my next question, which is all about sort of measuring DEI and measuring these impacts in a real tangible way and in a way that businesses can stand up and like be like, look, this is working for us in so many different ways. Is this something that Gen Z, for instance, are really caring about and demanding when they're looking at jobs, as opposed to previous generations, perhaps, who might not have really thought about topics like diversity or even sustainability, et cetera, before accepting a job offering?
We recently put out a survey to our community of 500 plus university society leaders. And we know that 86% of Gen Z are already looking at DEI data on company websites when considering whether they want to apply for a role. And 50% of them will dive deeper into the PDF reports to find, you know, what they're looking for. And this is confirmed, by the way, by other studies. Paul Polman, the former CEO of Unilever, did a survey last year and found that 71% of UK Gen Z employees want to work for a company that is trying to have a positive impact on the world. And half of them have actually resigned from a job because the values of a company did not align with their own. But one thing I also just want to add, it's really not just Gen Z. That same study showed that millennials care about these topics too, just not as pronounced as Gen Z. And if you take Gen Z and millennials together, you have everyone in the workplace between 18 and 41 years old. That's a pretty big part of the workforce.
And I think people do assume it is just the youngsters, in inverted commas. But I think that the working population, again, a generalization, but I think it's a truism, has changed since the pandemic. People go to work and expect different things from work. And to credentialize this, McKinsey, and I'll get into paraphrase, but I think I'll get it right. So McKinsey stepped back in 2021 and said, actually, are all these people leaving their jobs, the great attrition? And so they looked at Singapore, cross-sector, Singapore, UK, US, Australia, and Canada. And their findings were more or less the same in all those locations and cross-sector. Mm. So yes, and I won't give you the credentials around who was leaving, but definitely the volume was up. But this is the point. When those people that were going to leave were asked the question, why are you leaving? Yeah. It wasn't all to do with the paycheck. For the first time ever, the studies were showing it's to do with what the organisations in which they worked valued, yeah, and also how they were valued at work. And that is a sea change. We have been humanised by the pandemic. So I think to Ken's point, yes, Gen Z care, but actually people care generally. I mean, you know, Ken and I care where, yeah, we work. I'm sure, Nelly, you care where you work.
Absolutely.
That tangible intangible of how you feel, yeah, within your office culture.
100%. I mean, personally, I am a millennial and most of my friends are too. And it's, I don't think we would stay at a job anymore if we didn't fundamentally believe in what that organisation was doing, because it would completely impact my whole life. I'd be quite unhappy, I think. Yeah, no, definitely.
Yeah, and there's a famous phrase here, purpose over pay.
Yeah, and I think that's becoming more and more true, for sure. Yeah. So talking again a bit about the metrics and measuring all of this, Ken, what businesses do DEI well? And does your company literally have a league table? And who would be those gold star top performers in DEI?
There really are three industries that do DEI the best: finance, law, and consulting. And I would put shortly sort of after those three, I would say they're followed by tech and media companies. We have 48 leaderboards across those 500 companies that we track. And we have leaderboards for gender, ethnicity, mm-hmm, LGBTQ, disability, veterans, socioeconomic background. And for each of those leaderboards, you can filter on sector, allowing you to see those top performers across pay equity, overall workforce diversity, diversity in senior leadership and at the board level, mm-hmm, external recognition as an inclusive employer, public advocacy, and overall DEI transparency. And right now, the sort of, I would say you asked who are sort of the gold star kind of companies. At the top, KPMG, extremely transparent and very sort of lots of targets, BCG, Google, JP Morgan, where I was previously, but also, you know, the Bank of England does really well. And you have MI5 that shares a lot of diversity data. So, yeah, so there are, you know, some Channel 4 does extremely well,
yeah,
as does ITV, as does the FT.
So, Ken, is there potentially a danger of being tokenistic when applying DEI as a metric?
I would say maybe if a company just shares one or two metrics, and if those metrics are just focused on the D in DEI. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, if they just shared how diverse their overall workforce was, not also whether there is equity and inclusion. A company that is transparent about DEI shares how diverse their senior leadership is in terms of gender, ethnicity, LGBTQ, disability, socioeconomic, mm-hmm, background. And then for the E in DEI, which is equity, they provide pay gap data for each of those diverse groups. And this is something that many management consulting and law firms now do, including BCLP. And finally, for the I in DEI, they provide, which is inclusion, they provide breakdowns of their employee opinion survey results by diverse group.
Yeah.
And that's something that both Deloitte and Intel do.
Am I correct in saying that studies have actually shown that companies that do DEI well and embrace DEI end up being quite successful and can potentially be more profitable than those who don't?
Yeah, actually, I did a piece of research in the last couple of months, and I wrote a report for an organization called Open for Business. And what I did in that report is I reviewed close to 300 companies, the largest listed companies in the US, the UK, Germany, and Australia. And I looked at how transparent they were in their reporting on LGBTQ DEI. And what I found was that the top 25%, in terms of being the most transparent on that, were 2.3 times more profitable than the bottom 25. And this isn't the only studies. There are many others that clearly show that this does help with the bottom line.
We see this in the day-to-day,
yeah,
at BCLP. When we win deals, we win deals because we're an excellent law firm, but also because we have great core values and our clients feedback on that. So absolutely, it's a business imperative.
But also, you know, which company does not want to look like the customers and communities that they serve? I mean, that has to make them a better company, that has to make them more attuned to what the needs are of the customers and the communities they serve. So that really is beyond just being able to prove empirically that it's good for the bottom line.
Definitely. You know, I think everyone's now pretty familiar with the term greenwashing, but what is diversity washing and how prevalent is it?
Diversity washing is when a company claims to be committed to DEI, but does not back that up with measurable outcomes. I wouldn't say it's that prevalent. I think it's often more a case that companies are on a journey, and early on in that journey, it's difficult for them to share much in terms of progress. Take Self-ID, for instance. That's where a company asks employees to share their gender identity, ethnicity, sexual orientation, whether they have a disability, and their socioeconomic background. Getting that to a point where enough employees are ready to take part and trust the system, that can easily take a couple of years. So that means in the meantime that a company can't yet share any of that collected data because it won't be sufficiently representative. And I think that's completely understandable. And the company can, in the meantime, just share what that participation percentage is and how it's driving that up.
Just picking up on the self-ID point, Ken, I don't think it can be understated the importance of psychological safety in the workplace to create an environment where that trust that Ken speaks of is created, where people feel that they can self-identify, where people are able to call out bad behaviours or microaggressions. And just to give a definition of psychological safety for those people that may not know what it is, I think it's one of those buzz phrases that has suddenly come to life since the pandemic, but in fact, it's been around for decades. And so a psychologically safe workplace is a workplace where people of whatever seniority feel they can have the ability to speak candidly to each other without fear of reprisal. It's just about creating an environment where you can speak up, you're listened to, so people hear, you know, talk about speak up, listen up. But I would add to that act up so that, you know, it's not just going to be left in the ether. So if you create that environment, and it has to come from the very top to create a psychologically safe environment, you create that trust, which then will lead to more people self-identifying, etc. But I think psychological safety is the key, because coming back to the diversity washing point, if you don't have psychological safety, all of the attempts to have a DEI policy does become virtue signalling, just a messaging from the top. You have to have your population feeling that they can be vocal and get listened to.
Definitely. And I think that goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning as well, is about visibility. I mean, it's obviously a few steps beyond just being visible in the workplace, but being feeling safe, as you said, to have these conversations at every single level and not just at the bottom or in the top where it becomes disconnected, right? Like it has to be part of the whole organization. So I want to look ahead to the future. What do you both see the future of DEI being in the business world? Are there some emerging trends? I mean, I'm sure we've touched upon some of them already. Or areas that you believe will be increasingly important?
I think we've already talked about some of the trends that we're seeing coming through, but I think the future relates to a wider move for businesses to become more socially responsible, so responsible business conduct, the growth of the ESG umbrella, which of course DEI sits under the intersection of S&G. And I think you will see, so for law firms, for example, a real growth in pro bono work. And so to be reflective of the communities in which we operate, to support them, to support our populations within that identify in certain DEI strands. So it's the growth of the good corporate citizen in this widest sense.
Yeah.
That's the future, in my opinion.
And Ken, speaking of the future, because I know it's also something that you look at Window, is do you think that DEI will increasingly become linked to the sustainability conversation, which it obviously is, as you mentioned, Daisy, like a massive part of ESG already, but how it really ties in is foundational to sustainability as well.
Absolutely. So by the end of this decade, Gen Z, which is the most diverse generation yet, 48% are from an ethnic minority and 20 to 30% of them identify as LGBTQ+. This generation, by the end of the decade, will make up 33% of the global workforce. So that demographic shift is dramatically increasing the demand for transparency, commitment, and accountability in DEI efforts. And we're witnessing a paradigm shift where DEI is not just a standalone effort, but it's integrated into the broader agenda of DEI, of sustainability and corporate responsibility. And a growing trend that I'm seeing is the merging of DEI and ESG reporting into companies' annual reports. Bank of America is a great example here. So really bringing together financial and non-financial data, reflecting the interconnectedness of corporate performance with societal impact. And also, you know, we talked a lot about talent, but the emphasis on DEI is also increasingly mirrored in the investment world. Morgan Stanley did a report last year that revealed that 67% of Gen Z investors prioritize investment products and strategies that champion LGBTQ plus equity and inclusion. That means that companies have to be comprehensive in their DEI reporting in order to be evaluated on that. And one of the largest financial institutions is actually licensing Windows data to feed into a new investment platform they're building. So companies need to consider this not just from a talent lens, but from an investor lens.
Absolutely. Well, we're coming to the end. And before we say our goodbyes, I was wondering if there's any final thoughts or advice or anything you would like to leave with our audience.
DEI is alive and kicking.
I think I would say we are at a pivot point, but not an inflection point. And the pivot point comes back to what we were talking about earlier. Yes, there are voices which are much louder in terms of anti-DEI. So we have to keep our awareness up. But the reality is that at a corporate level, which drives, of course, the economies and the main economies in which we operate, it's still there. It is still alive and kicking.
That's incredibly encouraging to hear. Well, Ken and Daisy, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been an absolute pleasure.
No, thank you, Nelly. It's been great.
An absolute pleasure.